Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
This is a serious one. This is a tough one, too, because we in this province have the Youthful Offenders Act, the Young Offenders Act, that protects young people. There's all kinds of theories or explanations for why we have such a thing, but you can assume, you can expect, you can understand that, you know, kids will sometimes do stupid things. Kids will sometimes do things that a mature adult would not do because a mature adult is more capable of thinking through consequences and results and things like that. And so we don't apply the same force of the law to someone whose capacity for rational thinking and reasoning is not quite there. However, in the last little while, here in Hamilton, we had a stabbing of a student near Salt Fleet High School. We had this horrendous situation yesterday with a 15-year-old driver apparently running over or hitting a 15-year-old student who died. Can't have a license at 15 that I know of. Toronto, we had this case with this horrendous case where these eight girls who were 13 to 16 swarmed and stabbed to death a homeless man. What are the criteria, or at least when should we begin, when should the law charge kids as adults? Let me bring in Jeff Manishin. He is one of Hamilton's top defense lawyers, deals with things like this at times. Jeff joins us now. Jeff, how are you tonight?
Oh, good, Scott. How about you?
I'm good. I really appreciate you taking some time, because this is, to me, this is one of the toughest things. And I know some people would say, well, charge them all as adults. And I'm not going there. I think this is one of the toughest things in our system. And it's because I think that there are some things, some crimes, some actions that to me, it's impossible not to know that it's wrong. And that to me makes it very difficult at times to say, well, they should then remain as a young offender as opposed to being charged as an adult. From your perspective, is there any time when they should be charged, when a young offender should be charged as an adult?
Well, realize what we're dealing with here. They're charged under the Youth Criminal Justice Act. So it's not really the phrase isn't charged as an adult. They're charged under the Youth Criminal Justice Act if they're under 18.
Right.
The issue is, under what circumstances can and should the Attorney General seek to have an adult sentence? Because that's really what it is.
Okay.
Thinking about it. It's not simply, it's not the offense. A young person,
it's the penalty.
Under the Youth
Right.
Criminal Justice Act can be found guilty of breaking and enter or sexual assault or whatever. The issue is sentence.
Right.
So the question is, under what circumstances should the Attorney General apply to have the youth sentenced as an adult?
Do you believe there are, do you believe as a rule that there are circumstances where that should happen?
Well, I think the way that I phrase it is, sure, there certainly are, but I'm gonna go back for a moment and modify what you've spoken about, because you said the issue of appreciating whether it is or isn't a right or a wrong thing to do, that's not really the test. I'll give you what the test is in terms of an adult sentence. So what do I believe? Well, the Criminal Code and the Youth Criminal Justice Act provides for circumstances under which somebody could be dealt with as an adult. Works for me. The question is, where does the judge make that decision? There are a couple of features, and it simply says this, and it's one of those, you know, I always like to try and offer some education on it. A justice court shall order that an adult sentence be imposed if it is satisfied, so the burden's on the prosecution, that the presumption of diminished moral blameworthiness or culpability of the young person is rebutted, and a youth sentence wouldn't be of sufficient length to hold the young person accountable for his or her offending behavior. So they're looking at the moral culpability of the young person.
So what does that mean?
Risk-taking.
Translate that, Jeff.
The harm caused by the individual and the normative conduct of his character, the normative character of his conduct.
Translate the moral culpability. What does that mean? That they know
that's
it's wrong?
That's a great question, Scott. Moral culpability isn't simply applicable for any young person. It's there on all aspects for adults as well in sentencing. I think the way that I'd phrase it is, how wrong is the conduct? So you can have conduct that might occur that might be inadvertent but still criminal. You might have conduct that's deliberate. Conduct that might have occurred on a single occasion, conduct that's occurred on a number of occasions, conduct that might be impulsive and bad, conduct that might be extreme and protracted. How bad is the behavior from a moral standpoint?
And does part of that consist of...
I make submissions, you know, regarding moral culpability regularly for adults as well as young people.
Does part of that come down to, does the person or should the person realistically have known what they were doing was horrendous?
I think that, I don't know that they'd quite evaluate it that way. Okay, they allow for a diminished level of moral blameworthiness for a young person, and that builds in what you mentioned earlier, Scott. Young people's brains have not really matured and developed, so their ability to be able to make evaluations and judgments aren't nearly the same as an adult. So we might say, yeah, they know it's bad, but the issue of the evaluation and decision-making is not the same as an adult. So we have to recognize that. That's a critical component of dealing with young people. Other factors, though, that I mentioned for you, okay, the consequential harm caused by the individual. So that's how what happened? How bad was the harm? And the third one, the normative character of the conduct, in other words, how far it is or isn't in part related to what society's norms might say, as well as the young person. Okay, and then remember, too, the other part of it, in terms of the sentence, it has to be long enough to reflect the seriousness of the offense and the young person's role in it, and to provide, this is important, a reasonable assurance of the young person's rehabilitation to the point where the young person can be safely reintegrated into society. Okay, it's a balancing exercise for a judge. It's been interpreted by the courts. Accountable, what has to happen, moral culpability and intentional risk-taking, harm caused, and the character of the conduct.
And that the one of those parts is where I always struggle with this because, I was saying a few moments ago that if a kid breaks into a store and does something stupid, heaven knows we haven't all broken into a store, but we've all done something stupid in our life because we haven't thought it through. But taking this one in Toronto of these eight girls, we don't know all the details yet, but you'll never convince me that not one of those girls knew that what was going on was not just bad, but that was going to lead to a very bad outcome. This was not stealing a chocolate bar. This was extraordinarily serious. And I find it impossible to believe that they could not have, some of them could not have understood what was happening. That to me is very different from some of these other things that you might be facing.
Yeah, let me suggest to you, Scott, that what you're doing is mixing some metaphors. To find somebody not criminally responsible by reason of mental disorder, a court has to be satisfied the person wasn't capable of appreciating, because of a disease of the mind, the nature and quality of the act, or capable of knowing it was wrong. So the knowing it was wrong phrase comes in for a defense of not criminally responsible. The knowing it was wrong is not a component of the Youth Criminal Justice Act. So we have to segregate that part out. The issue of wrongful conduct is certainly identifiable, but the question then becomes, do you have to deal with the individual as an adult? And by the way, it can only happen for somebody 14 and up. Okay, you have to determine whether or not the potential sanctions that are available in the Youth Criminal Justice Act really aren't enough. It's more serious than that. And we know of cases of 15, 16, 17-year-olds, or what they do is sufficiently bad that, yeah, they've got to be dealt with as adults. If I'm not mistaken, that young guy in Alberta, if I'm not mistaken, killed a number of his classmates, dealt with as an adult. Many years ago, I was involved in the trial in Hamilton. I represented the third person, but of the other two that were charged, one of the two was 17 at the time. There was an application to have him transferred to adult court on a horrific first-degree murder, and he was transferred to adult court and sentenced, dealt with as an adult. So it can happen. It's just not automatically, really bad crime equals automatically adult sentence. It doesn't work that simply, Scott.
Yeah, and part of the other trick about this is that there are some 18-year-olds who would naturally, by definition, be charged as an adult and sentenced as an adult because they've reached that threshold that probably are way less mature than some 16-year-olds. Like the number, I get that we have to have a solid number, something to work with. You have to, you can't just sort of have this wishy-washy, well, we'll send them to a psychiatrist and see how they do. You have to have a number. But boy, it seems rather arbitrary at times because there are, as I say, there are some people who are younger but way more mature than older people who are way less mature.
Sure, although maturity isn't simply the answer. I can tell you I've represented some people, Scott, where they might be not long after the 18th birthday. And I say to a judge, but for a matter of a number of months, this individual will be treated under the Youth Criminal Justice Act.
Exactly.
It happens. But that you're going to draw a line somewhere. I was around at a time where we had the Juvenile Delinquents Act. I'm that old. And the maximum penalty for the Juvenile Delinquents Act, you know what it was, Scott? Training.
No idea.
Training school. That's what it said. It was training school. And you had young people who could be transferred to adult court then. And so ultimately, over time, we got into the Young Offenders Act with amendments, Youth Criminal Justice Act. There have been some increases in terms of the range of sentences, like maximum sentences can be imposed for young people. Remember, you can have a custodial term for a young person, too. So
yeah,
it's not a matter of they all get probation. No, bad enough offense for a young person dealt with as under Youth Criminal Justice Act can still get custody.
It's one that is very on the front burner right now because of all the things that are going on, whether by coincidence or something else. It certainly has been a lot of stuff happening in the last few weeks that have raised questions about this. Jeff Manishin, we always love having you on. Thanks for taking time today.
Certainly, Scott. Always a pleasure chatting. Bye.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
In the last few days, there's been some revived questions, some magnifying glass looking at some spending in Ottawa, specifically at one company that does contracting, consulting work, pardon me. Because in Ottawa, in the last number of years, the government has gone from spending $10.4 billion a year on outside consultants to $17.7 billion a year on outside consultants. Here in Hamilton, it was just a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, that there was an auditor's report that kind of shredded the city in some ways for hiring consultants, outside consultants, for work that didn't need to be done or that wasn't really specific or whatever else. Consultants are seemingly a way of life for governments of all stripe, of all party, of all levels. But when you consider how many people work for the government at all different levels, city, province, federally, do we need this many? There are over 350,000 federal employees in this country. Surely some of this work can be done by them, or surely we can find consultants that don't cost as much money as so many seem to do. I'm being a cynic here, suggesting maybe it's because they know it's the government as opposed to someone else, and so they can charge more. Larry Deani is a former mayor of the city. Of course, he's a political commentator. He joins us now. Larry, thanks for doing this today.
Hey, good evening, Scott.
It always strikes me as one of the things that you know, if you were to go through a government accounting, in one of the line items that's going to be big always is going to be consulting fees. Why is this?
Yes, and it's the bane of every politician at every level for sure. The city of Hamilton, I mean, I've lost track of specific numbers in the budgets now, but if you were to add up the cumulative amount of money for consultants at every level, whether it be in public works or planning or legal, you'd come up with a pretty penny for sure. And here's the issue. And we try to deal with it. We try to whittle it away when I was involved. But here's the issue, and here's what staff will tell you. That in spite of the fact that Hamilton has many, many employees, they don't have expertise in every single area. And so sometimes, many times, I would say, in order to get a piece of work done that requires a specific expertise, whether it's in legal or planning or public works, you need to either hire somebody on your staff to get that expertise or farm it out to a consulting company if it's work that you only need periodically. So, for example, if you want some specific work, say around, let me use a specific example, around, you know, the repaving of the Red Hill Expressway, which is a controversial subject, right?
Uh-huh.
There were a number of consultants that were hired to give the city advice on that. Now, as it turns out, the advice, and we are about to find out, may or may not have been sound, but you either have to hire that person and then keep them on the payroll forever or use them on a one-time basis for work that's done every 10 years. And so it's cheaper in the long run not to bring somebody on staff when you need that expertise only for a limited period of time, but rather to pay a one-time fee in consulting and be done with it.
But now, isn't it possible though, Larry, isn't it possible to have generalists? Because most companies will have people who are generalists who can speak to certain things that, you know, they may not be absolutely precisely dealing with that one specific issue, but they're capable of speaking to broad issues. It seems like, well, maybe we do that, but it's, or maybe we just have so many specific issues. I don't know. But it seems like in the private sector, you wouldn't do this nearly as much as we seem to in the public sector.
Well, in fact, the private sector uses consulting engineering firms, or at least consulting firms, as much as the government. Maybe it doesn't cost as much because, and again, this is the bone of contention, whenever government gets involved because of its very circuitous purchasing programs and processes, the dollar amounts seem to go sky high.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And that's a whole other issue, but that has to do with purchasing policies. You know, in the private sector, if you wanted a job done and you were quoted a certain price, and the guy across the street who does the same work quoted you a slightly higher price, but you like that person, you might go to him and say, "Hey, buddy, look, this guy is going to do this job for this amount. Can you sharpen your pencil?" And you do that. But in government, you cannot, because that even though it makes sense, but that opens the door to potential abuses. And so you've got all of these purchasing policies that simply have, you know, to dot every I, cross every T, and the amount that is charged for jobs goes sky high. But in terms of consulting work, though, I would say the private sector also uses consultants. It's just that it seems that the public sector, it becomes more of a flashpoint, especially when it goes through the political mill. Like, for example, this issue you're talking about that's happening right now in the federal government, and I don't have any specific details, of course, but the same firm that's been hired by this government was hired by the previous government as well. The only difference is that this government is paying more money. Now, why is that? Are they doing more work? Costs have gone up? Or is it that there's some hanky-panky going on? I bet you dollars to donuts, when we get to the bottom of it, you'll find out that there are explanations to why the cost is there. And they may or may not have anything to do with malfeasance. We hope it won't. But the issue is that every single government that comes along hires consultants, and that's just a way of life.
You mentioned the one in Ottawa, and this is the flashpoint one that has got this talking again. So under the previous government, under the Harper government, it was paid $2.2 million. Under the Trudeau government, it's been paid $66 million. So it's like it's not gone up by a little bit. It's grown exponentially. And again, Larry, I find it very hard. I've not worked in public sector. So, you know, I acknowledge that coming in, but I find it really hard to imagine what work anybody could possibly do over a few years that would be worth 66, unless there's, you know, building a plane or something where there's product involved in it, where there's things you have to buy. I find it hard to believe what possible advice you could give me that would be worth $66 million. It goes to your point. It seems as though we spend a lot of money when it's in the public sector that probably would be whittled down if it was private sector.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And obviously, those numbers are staggering, and that's why I think the government has issued an audit to come to some answers as to why things have gone up that drastically over just a few number of years. It's frustrating, I know. But the general answer to the question is that government doesn't have expertise in every area, and rather than hiring somebody and putting them on the payroll forever, they simply pay a one-time fee in consulting. But those numbers add up as you go across the board, and start adding consulting numbers or at least consulting dollars every time government does a job. And I think the right questions are being asked. But also, let me be a little bit cynical about the political lens, too, that opposition parties always want to make the government look bad.
100%.
And even though there may be a reasonable explanation, their spin is always going to be pejorative.
100%. Yeah. And I, Larry, we got to run, but I would say guaranteed 100%, 1,000%, I don't care who was in office, if any government was paying $66 million to someone, I think the questions would be asked, because especially if it's gone up from 2.2. We got to run, as I say, but just for the record, if anybody wants to hire me as a consultant for $66 million, I am available. You can reach me through my email here. I will happily work for you for $66 million. I'm sure Larry will as well.
Partners.
Thanks very much. Have a great night, Larry. Thank you.
You too.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.